We gather once again in this our sacred space. We feel a holy presence. The light of truth shines in through these clear glass windows, and the songs of faith and hope and love echo within these walls. We share a sacred time. We pause for Sabbath rest. This hour invites us to refresh our spirit, and the company of fellow seekers enriches our discovery. Enter the space, share the time, and find what is sacred and true for you. Well, as you can surmise from that first hymn, we're going to talk about lots of different ideas about God today. And there's a great book for kids, which is called What is God? By Eaton Gorenson. And I'm going to read you just a little bit. It's a long book, so I can't read it all. So I'm just going to read you a little excerpt of it. But in future weeks, when Jolene is here, our membership development coordinator and welcoming person, we have some copies you can borrow, or you can take a look. I'll leave it up here for people who might like to share more of it with their kids. It starts out with the question, what is God? You're asking a very big question. Boys and girls, grown-ups and old people, everyone wants to know, what is God? Maybe we can't really talk about God, because maybe we can't see God, or maybe we can't hear God, or even taste, or touch, or smell God. But maybe we can feel God, like we can feel love, or like we can feel happy or sad. Maybe God is what you feel when you stand on a very high mountain and see a big, beautiful view all around you. Or maybe God is what you feel when you hear beautiful music. Or maybe God is what you feel when you see a million stars at night and you feel very small looking up at them. Long ago, people thought the sun was God, like a very strong and great light that shines through and around everything. But now we know the sun is just one star, and it's really just one small star in a big universe filled with millions of stars. Some people think God is an old man with a long white beard who sits in the clouds and looks down at us all the time. They think this God knows everything, everything we do or say or think. And when some people talk about this God, they look up towards him in the clouds. Sometimes this God is a nice old man, but sometimes this God is angry. And some people think if they're not good, this God will be angry with them. Hey, next time you fly in a plane, look out the window at the clouds. But you know what? You won't see that God there because no one's ever seen that God. Maybe God is an eternal mystery. Eternal means forever and ever. And a mystery is like a big puzzle with lots of pieces you have to fit together. But some people think that there are teachers who have been able to, at least in part, solve the puzzle, what is God? These teachers have come from many places in the world and have talked in many different languages, trying to answer the question, what is God? People of the Christian religion understand God as the teacher Jesus taught them. People of the Jewish religion understand God as the teacher Moses taught them. People of the Muslim religion understand God as the teacher Mohammed taught them. People of the Buddhist religion understand God as the teacher Buddha taught them. And there were many, many more teachers who taught many, many different people many, many different things about God. But wait, we've only talked about the big religions. There are many people who believe that there are many gods, not just one God. And many people who believe in religious teachings but do not believe in any God. And there are some places in the world where you're not even allowed to talk about God. But in our country, everybody can believe the way they see right, the to believe according to his or her own religion. And everybody is allowed to ask and explore and talk about that question. What is God? Well, as you know, sometimes at this point in the service, I like to share a little vignette with you. And it ties in with our theme this morning a bit. So it's about a person who has a dog and a cat who she loves very much. And she gets up each morning, and this morning she goes and carefully prepares the dog food, putting all his favorite treats, a little bit of chicken, mixes it all up, puts it down for the dog, and the dog devours the food and is so grateful. He's so happy, and he perceives that the food is so wonderful. And he says, this food is so wonderful, and that person so generous, that person who provided this food for me must be God. Next, she prepares the cat's food. She mixes the favorite little kibbles and all the things that the cat likes and puts it down. The cat, much more reserved, is pleased with it all, and she does eat it all up a little more gracefully and slowly than the dog and licks her chops. And then she says, this food is so wonderful. Surely this must have been given to me because I'm God. I'd like to share two readings with you this morning. The first is from the Hebrew Bible, first book of Kings, chapter 19, verses 11 through 13. Little context. This reading is about the prophet Elijah. We meet him hiding in a cave. He's been through the high times of his life. His prayers for the end of a drought have been answered with floods. He's slain his enemy, the prophet of false gods. He's been proud and boastful and taken the lead in great celebrations, but things have changed. Now, he's withdrawn, depressed, fearful. His spirits are low. He's waiting for something, guidance, direction, perhaps for a flashy, powerful God experience, or perhaps not. Here's the account in the book of Kings. A great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks into pieces. But God was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake. But God was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But God was not in the fire. And after the fire came a still, small voice, a gentle whisper inside. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. And behold, there came a voice in him. And it said, what are you doing here, Elijah? And our second reading is from A New Christianity for a New World by John Shelby Spong. Jack, as he's called by most, is a retired Episcopal bishop and author of many, many best-selling books on liberal religion, and one whom I was privileged to have as a teacher as well as to count as a friend. His liberal views are very controversial in the Episcopal Church, and he is often welcomed in our tradition, having been our principal speaker at our Unitarian Universalist General Assembly just a few years ago. He writes this: theism is a human description of God that has died. I seek to walk beyond the carnage of that description into a new sense of God. A God met not outside of life, but at the very heart of life. My mind, my integrity, my intellectual questioning, and my God experience all come together in this new image. My religious schizophrenia is at an end. Theism is dead, I joyfully proclaim, but God is real. I'd like to begin with a story. It's actually a rather famous parable originally told by John Wilson, but so often told and adapted by the philosopher of religion, Anthony Flew, that it's most often associated with him. It goes like this. Two explorers come upon a beautiful clearing in the jungle. In that clearing, there are many lovely flowers, beautifully placed, as well as some weeds. One explorer says, "Someone must tend this garden." The other explorer disagrees. "There is no gardener," he says. So in order to resolve the question, they pitch a tent and stay quite a long time, but no gardener is ever seen. They set up barbed wire fence and even electrify it, and they patrol with bloodhounds, but no shrieks ever suggest that some intruder has received a shock. No movements of the wire ever betray an invisible climber, and the bloodhounds never picked up a scent. Yet still the believer is not convinced. But there is a gardener, invisible, intangible, insensible to electric shock, a gardener who has no scent and no sound, a gardener who comes secretly to look after the garden which he loves. At last, the skeptic despairs. But what remains of your original assertion? Just how does what you call an invisible, intangible, eternally elusive gardener differ from an imaginary gardener, or from even no gardener at all? Well, the skeptic in the story starts from the position of atheism. For her to believe in a God, there must be real, scientifically verifiable proof. The believer, the theist, starts from the position that there is a God, and therefore there must be absolute proof that eliminates every possibility of a God before she can change her mind. They take in the same moment of creation, but they do not understand it in the same way. As the parable makes clear, this effort to prove your theism or your atheism to a person of the opposite theological persuasion is simply unlikely to go anywhere. So let's not make that debate the focus of this sermon about God. But there are two other things that I believe are raised by the parable and the readings I shared with you that I would like to explore. The first is the observation that both explorers pause to take in the beautiful garden. Their action in the garden stems from the pause. This is a sensory experience that they both have. They experience this first at a primary level and only later think about the idea or the cause that they associate with it. The primary experience has an emotional impact. It is, in shop terms, a pre-theological experience. God or no God is an idea that comes later. That is the language that they put to the experience. Yes, it happens quickly, but as humans, we are not acting upon instinct here, but instead have the freedom and the ability to move from a primary experience of creation to an interpretation. And there is not one interpretation. We may interpret differently, but the most important piece is that we have the experience in common, the ability to pause and reflect upon it, and the freedom to label it, interpret it, and understand it as we will. The ability to pause and take in the moment of creation is really not a spiritual or religious experience, but it is the prerequisite. It is the experience required in order to have the religious or the spiritual experience. The ability to pause and experience a moment of creation is universal, but how you interpret that is personal to you. Basically, what I'm talking about is the theology of the father of all liberal theology, Friedrich Schleiermacher, and this understanding is the basis of the free church tradition. We do not have a creed that says we all have to process that experience in the same way. We have the same experiences, but also the freedom to interpret them theologically differently. The next point this story illustrates is that the believer's definition of God or the gardener changes. It becomes more and more qualified. As science brings new tests to the table, God does not pass the test. God becomes more and more qualified. Now, to the atheist, this is known as the death of God by 1,000 qualifications. It's a very prominent theory in atheism. But to the theist, it is the discovery of a new way to understand God that's consistent with their own time, just as the ancient understanding of God was in the context of the knowledge of that time. When it first became known that I was leaving my legal practice, now a long time ago, and entering Harvard Divinity School to become a minister, I received a variety of strange reactions. On several occasions, when someone learned I was going to go to school to become a minister, he or she would quickly say something like, "Oh, I don't believe in God." I'm sure they thought this would kind of quickly end the conversation, but it often did not, and they frequently became rather confused. First, if they found out I was going to be a Unitarian Universalist minister, and if they knew anything about our wide range of beliefs from theistic to non-theistic, they quickly became concerned that instead of slamming the door on a religious conversation, their statements might have accidentally thrown it open. Over time, I actually became used to this proclamation, so used to it that I formulated a pat response. I would reply, "I probably don't believe in the God you don't believe in either." Despite the warning against double negatives from my sixth grade English teacher, I rather liked that reply. For most who were unfamiliar with both our tradition and with contemporary theology, numerous ways of looking at the idea of God, my answer was perplexing, if not shocking. Okay. As a Unitarian Universalist, it is okay to say you don't believe in God. But it is also okay to say that you have a deep belief in God. We welcome and embrace folks with a wide variety of theological views, from the most traditional Orthodox theism to atheism. To be a member of this church, you are not required to profess a creed in a particular God, or any God for that matter. For us, what we believe is a matter of individual choice and not a membership requirement as it is in other traditions. There is a tendency among us to think that most others believe just as we do here, and we sometimes act in ways that suggest to others that their way of interpreting the experience of creation is inferior to ours. The point being, it's not always easy to live up to our embrace of theological diversity. But that is what we are called to do. That is who we say we are. And truth be told, many of us are not exactly sure what we do believe. Perhaps you initially came to this church because of what you no longer believed in another religion. I think it's quite easy to articulate the things in which we don't believe. But it's quite another matter to articulate the really fundamental things that we do believe. In life, we learn that there is much mystery, much that we cannot understand. I think the older you get, the more you learn that. Yet we still do desire to understand it. Many people have struggled with both what is ultimately true for them and then what to call it. I've had profound and rich conversations with some of you about your concept of God. Other members have expressed a dislike for the very term God. A colleague of mine once joked, "As a Unitarian Universalist minister, you have the freedom to preach on anything you want, except God." I hope he was wrong, and that we can have this discussion directly. No matter how or if we articulate it, we all share those profound pre-religious experiences, and we all claim some ultimate truths. In the words we just sang a few minutes ago, what we claim most earnestly is our living deity. Like everyone else, at times we struggle with the big questions. We search for meaning, and we struggle to define our truth. It is the struggle, this engagement with ultimate questions, that makes us more than just a social club or a group of do-gooders. It's what makes us a religious people. We, like those before us, are in fact religious because we, both with our faith and with our doubts, do explore big questions. Just like those who lived in biblical time, we make meaning of our world experience with the tools and learning of our age, just as they did with the tools and learning of their age. And we don't all come out at the same place. And that's fine. For some of us, the traditional loving parent God remains a viable belief. And I have seen the comfort this belief can provide and honor and respect that belief in those who hold it. But for many others, the traditional idea of God as an all-powerful creator, controller, patriarchal being, existing in human likeness in some different perfect world of another dimension, is not believable or meaningful. For some Unitarian Universalists, as well as those from many other religions, this God is more than just not believable. It's been damaging. The patriarchal archy of the male deity and the lowly position of women in relationship to him seems to demean women and prevent them from enjoying equal rights in many traditions. In many churches, the teachings ascribed to this God prevent women from contributing to society in roles beyond that of mother or homemaker, and certainly bar them from meaningful ministry in those religions. Many of us, often after painful periods in our lives, have in fact rejected the idea of a vengeful, judgmental God ready to punish us in this life or the next, often for things over which we had no real control. We have finally freed ourselves from that pain, and we're not sure we want to get close to any God concept again. Still others, whose learned minds are guided by rational inquiry and the scientific method, find this ancient God inconsistent with evolution and theories of causation and other well-accepted scientific theories, and thus reject the idea of God. Finally, others have simply lost faith in this God when they felt that he or she was not there for them, particularly in extreme times, such as the genocides we experienced in the last century. They questioned, why, if God is all-powerful, did he not intervene? If God is all-loving, how could he let this happen? The conclusion for some is that in a world where this can happen, there must be no God. These questions have not only been asked on a grand scale of world events. Most of us who grew up with this view of God and encountered tragedy or injustice have probably asked the same questions. When this particular God was not there for us, we, along with many philosophers and theologians, declared indeed that God was dead. Yet, 75% of Americans say they believe in God. But what does that mean? Many rabbis, ministers, priests still teach some flavor of that traditional God. But many, many others, not just among Unitarian Universalists, but also in liberal temples and churches of many denominations, now mean something very different by the term God. While some have rejected the notion of God and find it unnecessary for their spiritual life, many others have instead looked to redefine God. Now, that practice should not be surprising to us. Redefining God in terms of our own time and understanding of the world is, in fact, what people have done for centuries and centuries. On our Unitarian side, we reshape the idea of God with the application of the rational enlightenment thought to biblical teachings. On our Universalist side, we rejected the notion of vengeful God hundreds of years ago. Our Transcendentalist forebears found God in nature and believed in direct, first-hand experience of the sacred, not mediated experience, We've redefined this term God in many, many ways throughout the ages. Those former colleagues of mine in my legal profession days, who quickly proclaimed to me their disbelief in God, operated from the premise that the term God means just one thing, and therefore they thought all ministers must be operating to advance that view. Surely, when you've spoken with folks from other religions, they may have said something to the same effect. You know, oh well, we all have different religious ideas, but we all believe in the same God. Now, although out of politeness, I sometimes say nothing when that's said to me, in my heart I'm saying, not so fast. I need to know a lot more about how you experience God before I can agree with that statement. The idea that there might be other concepts of God than the orthodox, all-powerful, patriarchal, controlling old man with a beard who exists apart from the world has just never been considered by many folks. Well, today we barely scratched the surface in this exploration of other ways one might view God. And as we do, I pose two broad questions. Is there a way to understand God that fits within our post-Enlightenment scientific minds and is comfortable within the naturalistic worldview? And is there reason to continue to use the term at all? On both questions, I know some will disagree with my conclusions, and my reason for preaching this theological sermon is not an effort to convert those who are comfortable with their beliefs, either with the traditional God or with no God. If your theology is working for you, my job is to support you on that journey, and I hope you know you will. Rather, I hope to increase understanding of some of the different theological approaches of our time. There are many sources of other ideas of God, both ancient sources and modern. 20th century theologians of our own denomination and many others have described the God belief in ways that are consistent with our present worldview. Feminist theologians, process theologians, and others have explained God in ways new and meaningful to many. Some start with fresh new ideas, while others return to ancient scripture and examine those same texts that gave us the troubling God to see if there are other ideas present. A minority view, if you will, of God. And perhaps surprisingly, the idea of a different kind of God, not superhuman being residing in some far-off world, but a force of connection, conscience, and love, comes to us from the same ancient scriptures that brought us the other God. There is indeed a minority view of God to be found in the Hebrew and Christian scriptures. This morning I read you one of those passages from scripture that I believe presents an idea of God very different from the prevailing notion of the Hebrew God. In fact, it takes it right on in that passage. God's not in the showy, powerful forces of the world. Rather, God is in the still, small voice speaking within Elijah. God is not made known to Elijah in spectacular ways, but is manifested as a voice of conscience. His experience of God, a God who is about to give him some moral instruction, is a guiding voice within him. Many theologians and religion leaders of our times have left the old God behind, and sometimes have affirmed the God experience, and at the same time have affirmed the God experience in their lives. And one such person is John Shelby Spong, whose words I shared with you in the second reading. And I think some of the little bit of that is worth repeating. He wrote that theism is a human description of God that has died. I seek to walk beyond the carnage of that description in a new sense of God, a God met not outside of life, but at the very heart of life. My mind, my integrity, my intellectual questioning, and my God experience all come together in this new image. Well, many 20th century theologians have had new images of God. Paul Tillich described God as the ground of our being. Henry Nelson Wyman, described God as creative interchange. We may know God as simply the power of unconditional love, the spirit of life that flows through and among us, the source of good, the conscience that defines evil and steers us in another direction. We may meet God in the eyes of our neighbor, on a path in the woods, in the stars of the sky, or in the hunger of the poor. For me, the presence of that still small voice is the eternal flame of light that guides and the hope that doesn't fail. My life is a journey, and I've experienced on that journey moments of grace, blessings bestowed upon me that I did nothing to earn or deserve. And I've had times of unique understanding, powerful inspiration, and deep moments of compassion that have guided me in how I lead my life. Holding these as God experiences reinforces the profound sense of mystery which I lead in my life. There are many ways to describe what I'm speaking of without the term God. And if you've been coming here for a while, you know that I often do that. We all translate here either up or down on the theological scale so that the message fits into our own theological framework. And that is how it should be. But I also use the word God. One of my colleagues described my God as having a smaller lowercase g. And in a way, that's true. We need not give up the term God to those who refuse to continue on the theological journey, to those for whom revelation is closed and whose ideas of God have stagnated. If we do relinquish the term God totally, I think we run the risk of removing ourselves from meaningful participation in the moral debates of our time. It is important that we not only contribute to those debates, but contribute our liberal views to the idea of what God is. A symbol God has throughout the ages, the symbol God has throughout the ages, been wide enough to hold inconsistent ideas, and I believe it still is. Using the term God can enrich our present ideas and allow us to connect our contemporary ideas with the ancient wisdom. Now, I know some of you have views very similar to mine, and others have views that are very different. For all of us to believe, for all of our beliefs to continue to evolve, and that is what it should be in our tradition, yet we are together in the primary experience we all share. Those moments before we put on the theological labels. Those moments when we reach across theological division and connect at a deeper level, a level that's deeper than ideas or words. Revelation is indeed ongoing, and the light of ages still continues to shine among us, I think in new and powerful ways, suited to our time and our way of making meaning. Words of benediction today come from Robert Marby Doss. For all who see God, may God go with you. For all who embrace life, may life return your affection. For all who seek a right path, may a way be found, and the courage to take it, step by step. Let us now sing together our benediction printed in your order of service.